evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Tuesday, July 23rd, 2024. A South Sudanese lawyer has expressed interest in suing the Bank of South Sudan for unfair employment practices.
Of course, I submitted my notice of intent to sue the Bank of South Sudan on 19th of July, which is last Friday. And on Monday, yesterday, I served the Bank of South Sudan with a copy of my notice of intent to sue them.
And authorities in Malakal say they are prepared for looming floods across the state.
They are constructing a dike around the town that is already started, although it is not completed, but it is there in plan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in Upper Nile State say they are prepared for floods expected in the coming months. Weather experts say farmers are worried they may lose their livelihood again if proper measures are not put in place by the government to protect them. For VOA News, Mamer Abraham Kwart reports from Malakal.
James Manluk is the chairperson of the Floods Mitigation Committee in Upper Nile State. He says the state government is ready to respond to the anticipated floods across the state. He says there are no reports of floods in other counties across the state.
For any appearing of the flood, we are ready to respond. The way forward to the community that may be the effect according to location, we are ready.
The government of the state. And we target the lowland and island to unusual support. We do need to speak on the report from the owned areas.
The coordinator of the South Sudan Government's Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Nasir County says residents of Nasir Town who have experienced floods since last year are also planning to address similar effects.
The county authority, we started with the mobilization and awareness for the community to be alert about the floods that is going to happen. August or September will be the month that we will face a lot of challenges regarding the floods. This was number one. Number two, we are lacking tools to construct some dikes to protect the people. But we are starting with the small tools that we have, especially in Nasir Town. We are constructing a dike around the Nasir Town that is already started, although it is not completed, but it is there in plan.
Lem Wonjok, a resident of Malakal Town, says the state government is not doing enough to sensitize people on what to do when floods hit.
We were hopeful that maybe this year it is not going to rain heavily. Now it seems to be a drought because we have just only little rain all the day. But we say if it continues like this, they should be production. But if it is going to rain heavily, if it is going to flood in the beginning of August to September, it will not produce anything. Some areas are now people are clearing it, hoping that they will plant if there is another heavy rain.
South Sudan's floods preparedness report says the floods of 2019 to 2022 affected Jonglei, Upper Nile, Warab, Northern Bahrel Ghazal, Unity, Lakes, Central and Eastern Equatorial States, displacing about 900,000 people every year. The United Nations estimates half the populations of South Sudan live in flood-prone areas. For VOA News, I am Amir Abraham Kwart, reporting from Malakal, Upper Nile State.
From Malakal, we move to Juba, where Gabriel Kwart Agok Deng, an advocate and a legal consultant, has submitted his notice of intent to sue the Bank of South Sudan for what he calls discriminatory, unfair, and unprofessional recruitment practices. Akok says he also notified the administration of the bank about his next move. He says 83 of his clients signed contracts with the Bank of South Sudan, but were surprised to see the institution hiring new employees.
The interview was conducted by the opinion consultancy firm called Chima HR Limited. The interview was conducted on 21st February, and the results for that interview were brought out, whereby 83 candidates succeed to obtain the passing mark of 50% and above. From there, my client were promised by the Bank of South Sudan to sign the contract immediately after the renovation of the Bank of South Sudan branches in Malakal, Moore, Rumbek, and the general headquarters in Juba. Recently, on foot, the bank decided to put aside the successful candidates of 2023, which were 83 in total, and decided to make a fresh recruitment using a new employment company. So that prompted my client to ask about the right, and they were promised him they took almost 4 years being patient, waiting for this job to take over their positions. They were not even looking after other job opportunities. They compromised. Some ended their contract in NGOs in the state and flown to Juba, waiting to sign the contract.
You said you have made your intentions clear to the Ministry of Justice that you are filing a case against the Bank of South Sudan. Have you notified the Bank of South Sudan about your intentions? And if so, what was their reply?
Of course, I submitted my notice of intent to sue the Bank of South Sudan on 19th of July, which is last Friday. And on Monday, yesterday, I served the Bank of South Sudan with a copy of my notice of intent to sue them. The notice was received by the Bank Office of the Deputy Governor for Admin and Finance, and yet there is no response up to now. So I'm expecting, more especially from the Minister of Justice, to give me a green light, permitting me to sue the Bank of South Sudan.
This is the first time I'm hearing lawyers are concerned about discriminatory methods of employment in South Sudan. I also saw the list of those who sat for the exams, and I was wondering just about the composition of the list. I'm not saying that employment is a community right, but merit-based process can not only favor certain communities and leave out certain communities. What is your take on the composition of that list?
My take is that we as lawyers are much concerned to address the legal issues, especially to those who claim for the right, like my client now. So, though I have an observation, that's not my concern. My concern is whenever there is a victim and that victim contacted me to represent him or her, I think it is my obligation to represent him or her. So the nature of discrimination.
How many cases of this nature have you handled in the past? I'm asking this because I have been talking to a lot of South Sudanese who are also complaining that the non-governmental organizations, especially the international non-governmental organizations, are only employing South Sudanese from certain areas. And some people have come up openly saying that the jobs within the international non-governmental organizations are, a privilege of the few. Have you handled such cases before?
Yes, of course. This one is not new to me. Even last year, I was handling a case representing my client who was once working with the International Red Cross Committee, something of that kind. I managed to succeed the case, and my client was reinstated. My client was discriminated, and he was also unfairly dismissed. And this was something connected with the issues to do with tribal basis.
Talk to me about labor laws in South Sudan as far as employment is concerned, especially the recruitment process, because sometimes you see jobs being advertised, and after that, that's it. Those who advertise those jobs would not even tell you how they went through the process and how they ended up choosing the right candidates. The culprits in this process are international non-governmental organizations who hide behind their mandates and violate labor laws in the country. Talk to me about the labor laws. What is required and what is not required?
Of course, the employment opportunities under labor law mostly is that it provides that South Sudanese with the relevant qualification needed must be given a priority when there is any vacancy position. Looking at the contact of the international organization operating in the Republic of South Sudan, you may find now a lot of national organizations and international organizations are being run by foreigners.
What should South Sudanese do to get themselves out of this situation where they are looking for jobs and the jobs are there, but they are not given the jobs? And you have people who are from outside the country who use all sorts of means to fill those positions with the individuals who do not qualify for it or who are not supposed to get those jobs. What should South Sudanese do?
Our people need to be aware of the right to equal employment opportunities. And if they feel that they are discriminated, they should have to take up legal action against such institutions to claim their rights. It is the only best way to claim and fight for their rights.
That's Gabriel Kwart Akok Deng, an advocate and legal consultant. He spoke with me from Juba earlier today. This program made several calls to the Bank of South Sudan for comments on this story, but our calls were not picked. Ugandan police detained several demonstrators in the capital, Kampala, today as scattered anti-corruption rallies began, despite being banned by authorities. A journalist with the French news agency AFP says police were sent out in force across Kampala. Police spokesperson Kituma Risoke says authorities will not allow a demonstration that will risk peace and security of the country. Several protesters were arrested as small rallies began, including two near the parliament. However, nearby roads were cut off by security forces, preventing protesters from accessing the legislature. On the eve of the rally, Ugandan authorities cracked down on the opposition surrounding the headquarters of the National Unity Platform of former presidential candidate Bobi Wine and arresting several of his supporters. Still on the Ugandan protesters, the authorities there say the country's parliament was briefly under siege when protesters marched to express their displeasure over the government's handling of corruption. But law enforcement and President Yoweri Museveni have other plans. The police and the military surrounded the headquarters of Bobi Wine's National Unity Platform offices on Monday. Assistant Commissioner and police spokesperson Kitumba Risoke tells VOA's James Batty the police took preemptive steps to prevent any mobilization.
The plan of the police is that we are uncomfortable with the procession and we have communicated to the organizers. We invited them for a meeting at police headquarters to discuss modalities and how to go about it. We had some disagreements and we have advised them to devise more civil approaches, because we sense there is a likelihood of chaos.
In a way, are you trying to stop them from protesting or marching to the parliament, or you are trying to give them alternative routes?
Why we can't get them alternative routes? Because the nature of mobilization they made does not accommodate that kind of environment. When you look at their placards, they were calling people from all directions. It is not something small and organized and something that can be facilitated by security.
If I quite understand what you're saying, is the police saying there should be no march to parliament?
In the circumstances, given the nature of mobilization and the organizational arrangement, we feel it is unsafe and we condemn it. So we are not going to give in to it.
They say they have a constitutional right to protest.
Yeah, Bwana Bate, that constitutional right is what we want them to come and we participate in having it observed without disrupting the lives of other Ugandans, without disrupting the peace of other Ugandans, without bringing in situations of insecurity. And we are saying that right, we recognize it, but it is not absolute. It cannot be exercised
in a total disregard of other people's rights.
I'm reading that the police and the soldiers, you have sealed off the headquarters of the NUP party, the opposition party. What is the connection between the protest and the opposition party?
We treated the National Unity Platform incident on its own merits. What happened was that they called for a press conference today. Now, the uniqueness about the conference this time around was they called every party member, they called every member of parliament who subscribes to NUP, councillors, pressure groups. The mobilization manner is similar to that of the procession scheduled for tomorrow. The numbers depict something unlikely to breach. So it gives security room to draw suspicions that something is not adding up well.
I know that Uganda is a democratic country, and there's the freedom of movement, freedom of association, and the freedom to gather. Right now, it sounds to me the government or the police is trying to dictate to the opposition when and where they can meet.
Ndugubate, that's not exactly the point. We would not wish to be here, but these political actors are pushing us to a situation and in a corner where we find we have nothing left but to stick to the ground rules and ensure that the peace and the tranquility in the country is not disorganized, that we do not give room to anarchy or situations that can disrupt public order.
That's Kitumba Risoke, Assistant Commissioner and Police Spokesperson in Uganda. He spoke with VOA's James Batty earlier Tuesday. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the U.S. presidential race for the White House takes a different path. Find out why after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. U.S. Secret Service Director Kimberly Chetley resigned today after lawmakers on both sides of the aisle called for her to testify about the agency's failure to prevent the assassination attempt against Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on concerns about security during the upcoming elections season.
9 days after the assassination attempt that shook the nation, there are few answers on how the shooter got so close to Trump. The head of the United States Secret Service, Kimberly Cheadle, answering lawmakers' questions about the shooting for the first time, was blunt.
We failed.
Cheadle said a full report on the agency's failure to protect the former president would be released within 90 days. Lawmakers said that was unacceptable during an election season that has already proved to be contentious. Some called on her to resign. Republican Representative James Comer.
The Secret Service has a zero-fail mission, but it failed on July 13th and in the days leading up to the rally. The Secret Service has thousands of employees and a significant budget, but it has now become the face of incompetence.
Cheadle told lawmakers Trump's Secret Service detail was aware of a suspicious person before the former president spoke at the rally.
If The detail had been passed information that there was a threat. The detail would never have brought the former president out onto stage.
One analyst told VOA the early warnings about the shooter raised serious questions. Dr. Scott White is director of the cybersecurity program at the George Washington University.
Most definitely, there was a failure here to neutralize the threat when it was immediately observed. And quite frankly, it would have been a legitimate to shoot that young man once he was on the roof. It would have been a legitimate shooting, a legal shooting. So I don't know why there was hesitation.
Congressional Democrats called for changes to gun laws in the United States, saying it was unfortunate that former President Trump is now one of many victims of gun violence. Democratic Representative Jerry Connolly.
We almost lost a presidential candidate the other day. A 20-year-old had access to his father's AR-15 and got on top of a roof within 500 yards or feet of the podium. And I'm asking you, did the availability of that AR-15, which is replicated all across America, make your job harder or easier? And you're not willing to answer that question?
The Federal Bureau of Investigation has still not determined a motive for the actions of Thomas Matthew Crooks, the suspected shooter. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Still on the assassination attempt on former U.S. President Donald Trump, a recent assassination attempt on former U.S. President Donald Trump should be a wake-up call on gun violence, says Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy, who recently declared firearm violence in America a public health crisis. But disagreements on how to resolve the matter prevail. VOA's Veronica Baldres Iglesias has more.
The July 13th shooting of former U.S. President Donald Trump left U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy horrified, he told the Associated Press.
We lose nearly 50,000 lives every year to gun violence. My hope is that we can shift from looking at it as a polarizing and political issue and see it for what it is, which is a public health issue that affects all of us.
Last month, Murthy's office issued the first ever advisory on firearm violence. He noted that 54% of Americans have experienced gun violence either directly or through a family member, and suggested approaches to address what he deems a public health crisis.
This includes implementing community violence prevention programs and firearm risk reduction strategies, improving access to mental health care for those exposed to or at risk for firearm violence.
The pro-gun National Rifle Association told VOA in a statement that it is, quote, an extension of the Biden administration's war on law-abiding gun owners. Amy Swearer with the conservative research group Heritage Foundation shared similar views.
Progressive liberal policies are simply failing to protect the public. They're failing to enforce the laws that already exist. They're routinely just churning out the same small subset of the population that is overwhelmingly responsible for the vast majority of violent crimes. And they just keep churning them out instead of putting them in prison.
VOA asked several American voters whether the attempt on Trump's life changed their perspectives on gun possession.
I think if you know how to handle one safely, that you should get one. And now with the climate as it is, I think more people should look at arming themselves and protecting their homes.
There's too much violence in America, and we need to be more specific about our gun control. I don't like to see anyone get hurt.
Researchers say beyond the critical but difficult national conversations on policy, there are measures that can be taken at the grassroots level to prevent firearm-related deaths, most of which were suicides in 2022.
Teaching ourselves suicide prevention skills, being unafraid to reach out to people and have difficult conversations, right? Building structures to report care and concern, and then people to connect and create intervention plans.
Schools, workplaces, faith, and community centers could all participate in those efforts. Peterson pointed out. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Still in the United States, Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister, is in Washington this week with a scheduled speech to Congress and meeting at the White House. The Israeli Prime Minister is landing in the middle of U.S. political turmoil following President Joe Biden's decision Sunday to withdraw from presidential race, which could add another layer of uncertainty to U.S.-Israeli relations at a crucial moment in the Gaza war. White House bureau chief Patsy Widakwaswara has this review.
Israeli strikes in eastern Khan Yunis killed dozens of people Monday. Hundreds more fled after evacuation orders. This is the scene that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu left to travel to another battlefield, this one political, as the U.S. presidential campaign is upended following President Joe Biden's decision not to run for a second term.
And I will tell my friends on both sides of the aisle that regardless who the American people choose as their next president, Israel remains America's indispensable and strong ally in the Middle East.
That is what the Israeli leader says publicly. But analysts say in the potential race for the White House between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump, Netanyahu would prefer a Republican. Jonathan Reynolds, head of the Department of Political Studies at Israel's Bar-Ilan University, via Skype.
The Republicans are more supportive of Israel's security agenda, and that would be true whoever was in power in Israel. But the second thing is they're more forgiving of Israel's right-wing government and its policies towards the Palestinians.
Netanyahu has reportedly requested a meeting with former President Trump, who launched significant pro-Israel policies during his term. Trump brokered the Abraham Accords that normalized Israel's diplomatic ties with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. He moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to contested Jerusalem and recognize Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights. Former U.S. negotiator for the Middle East, Aaron David Miller, via Skype.
With Kamala, he's probably going to get someone who will remain pretty much mainstream when it comes to supporting the U.S.-Israeli relationship, but I think far tougher, certainly rhetorically and Israeli settlement activity, and much more sympathetic to Palestinian suffering and Palestinian rights.
Ultimately, Netanyahu's main goal in Washington is to prepare the groundwork for the next American administration. And with the Israeli Knesset nearing a three-month recess, advancing his own goals in his fragile coalition, said Nimrod Goren, senior fellow for Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute via Zoom.
There may be a political timing that will enable Netanyahu to make a move once the Knesset is in recess without having that lead to immediate coalition breakdown, because that could not be done until the Knesset comes back to operation.
During that time, Netanyahu could potentially go against far-right factions in his coalition and reach a ceasefire deal with Hamas after nearly 9 months of war. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said last week such a deal is within reach.
I believe we're inside the 10-yard line and driving toward the goal line and getting an agreement that would produce a ceasefire, get the hostages home, and put us on a better track to trying to build lasting peace and stability.
However, most analysts are skeptical the ceasefire deal will extend beyond phase one, a six-week pause in fighting in exchange for some of the hostages held by Hamas. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
That's all we had on our menu for this Tuesday, July 23rd, 2024. We now leave you with a song, Binia Juba by Kuzos Clan. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Cornelius, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. Bini ya tuba, 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 bini ya tuba
باب واحد سنتين الفار حسبته بين الجبة بين نفس الركار شو كيف جميل زي ميري ماتيان وربته بنية بشكل جو جربته زي ميس ملايكا she goes out and not every weekend I like that